This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, the month of October here across the nation, including Northwest Indiana. We're going to bring back the topic here and talking with the people involved the closest with this type of issue. The St. Jude House here in Northwest Indiana deals with helping people dealing with domestic violence of all types. And with us, Val Lay is the Director of Development for the St. Jude House. And Val, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for helping us draw attention to the issue of domestic violence.
First off, there is a very special program that is underway this evening, a candlelight vigil and program. Tell us a little bit about that, where it's going to be, if people would like to participate and all.
Yes, thank you. It is tonight, October 1st. It's our 23rd annual Silent March and Candlelight Vigil. The location for the vigil is meeting on the lawn of the First United Methodist Church of Crown Point, which is located at 352 South Main Street. The Silent March begins at 6:30. However, community members may wish to come earlier to view and discuss the resources provided by St. Jude House and other community partners. In addition, we will display our clothesline project, which is a visual display of T-shirts with graphic messages designed by women survivors of domestic violence. The vigil program begins at 6:45. The program is held to honor and remember all those whose lives have been lost to domestic violence, as well as to support all the victims impacted by domestic violence. Two survivors will share their inspiring testimony. We will also share a video of the survivor who illustrates the impact of financial abuse on her family and how she overcame those obstacles.
One of the things that we have touched on in the past and we bring up every time during October, during this very special month, Domestic Violence Awareness Month, is to define for people that may not even know it can be definable what domestic or intimate partner abuse is. Val, will you define that for us, please?
Yes. Domestic violence is a pattern of coercive, controlling behavior in any relationship that is used to gain or maintain power and control over an intimate partner. The behaviors can include physical abuse, emotional or psychological abuse, sexual abuse, or financial abuse. It can be verbal or physical. This does include couples who are married, couples living together, or those who are just dating. It also can include parents, children, family members, and friends. In the U.S., there are 2 million injuries and 1,300 deaths every year caused by domestic violence.
I think it's important to note, and many people do not know this, that it doesn't have to be limited to women, that men can be victims as well. Is that true?
Yes, that is true, and St. Jude House can and does house men and their dependent children, as well as women and their dependent children.
Now, we know that this, in turn, being pointed out, especially during Domestic Violence Awareness Month, makes it probably more significant. What is the significance of having it in October?
Well, it is our national month for recognizing domestic violence. It's not a subject that is very easily discussed, but it affects everyone. For example, every minute, 20 people in the U.S. become victims of intimate partner violence. That's every minute. And 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men have experienced some form of physical violence by an intimate partner. Domestic Violence Awareness Month is meant to bring attention to the issue and to remind our community that there are still countless people, victims and survivors, their children and extended families, their coworkers, and their communities that are impacted by domestic violence. The silence about domestic violence must be broken if the generational cycle is going to be broken.
Now, how do you and the folks there at the St. Jude House help break that silence?
Well, I think it's important to note that St. Jude House was built to be a shelter, and unlike other domestic violence shelters, our address is published and publicized, including a large sign in the front yard. And that grew from the desire of the founders to have victims of domestic violence know where they could find help and to make the larger community aware of the impact of domestic violence.
How do you assist someone that may be a victim of domestic violence and getting help or needs the help? How can they do so?
They will, usually people will call our crisis line number first to get to answer some questions and get some advice from our client advisors and ensure that we do have the resources to help them. Our crisis line is 800-254-1286, and it is answered 24/7 year-round.
We're talking with Val Lay, who is the Director of Development for the St. Jude House. It's located in Crown Point. And especially note during this Domestic Violence Awareness Month that it's also not only does it involve emotion, but it also involves financial violence of some type. I'm kind of outlined that here earlier. But I know that, Val, that there's a very special program that helps with the people that need some financial empowerment, I guess, for like maybe a lack of a better way to put it. St. Jude House is working very closely with some local organizations and a very important national support as well, too. Tell us a little bit more about the Allstate Foundation's very special program, the Purple Purse Campaign.
The Purple Purse Campaign will be October 2nd through October 31st, and it is and has been sponsored by the Allstate Foundation for the last 15 years. One in four women experience domestic violence, and financial abuse is often why they just can't leave. So financial abuse includes things like limiting access to cash and credit cards, or drowning the victim in debt, or preventing them from keeping a job. So the Allstate Foundation Purple Purse is a program that's committed to shedding light on the on this invisible weapon that we hardly ever talk about.
Now, how does the St. Jude House help participate along with the Allstate Foundation in the Purple Purse campaign every year?
Well, there are two ways. We are extending our influence this year. But first, we are participating in the Purple Purse campaign, and we do have an online Purple Purse 2018 challenge. It says St. Jude House 2018 Purple Purse Challenge. Mm-hmm. So donations can be given October 2nd through October 31st. However, we wanted to go a step farther than that, and we have had grant support from the Allstate Foundation, which allowed us to partner with Centaur Bank and Lakeshore Public Media for video production to create videos that will speak to the topics of budgeting, credit repair, and insurance. And we have these on our website, www.stjudehouse.org/financial empowerment. We also have a fourth video of a survivor of financial abuse, which can give people an answer to, am I being financially abused? How will I get out of it?
Now, you mentioned the videos are available on your website right now. Is the chances there, or is it planned to expand being able to put these videos out so more people can see them here in Northwest Indiana?
There are worksheets that are associated with those videos. Mm-hmm. We plan to put them on YouTube, and we also have services for non-residential clients so that we can offer this training in-house to our residential clients and also to non-residential clients. Further in the future, we would like to offer it to offer the program at the public library or other such venues that the general public can attend.
Do you think that this would be a great opportunity to be able to expand this idea beyond just the month of October?
Oh, yes. We definitely see it as a part of our mission to bring awareness to the community about all the issues surrounding domestic violence. Well, St. Jude House has a community partners program which engages local businesses to support our mission and to become informed of the impact of domestic violence. Employed individuals spend the majority of their waking hours at work, and that's why employers are ideally suited to spot the symptoms of domestic violence and to intervene. Executives can promote a culture that includes domestic violence awareness and prevention and share information about domestic violence at the employee's orientation. It is powerful to understand the fact that domestic violence victims lose a total of 8 million days of paid work each year, and that is equal to 32,000 full-time jobs.
When you offer up not only the videos, the other information here during this very special month, and you have the opportunity to talk to people in person, help counsel them, and give them some assistance, do you get any reaction, any words of encouragement that come back to you there at the St. Jude House to continue doing what you're doing because it seems to have helped people?
Well, yes, we have a substantial support from the community at large in terms of inviting us to speak about these issues. We speak at churches and schools. Also, we work with law enforcement.
I guess, do you get any reaction, good or maybe unfavorable reaction? Is it mostly good?
I think that the reaction from the community is always good. People may not have known that we were here or what we do, but when they find out, they understand that that is an important resource for them. And the best thing that we can do or that anyone can do to assist someone who's struggling with domestic violence is just starting a conversation with that person and speaking up. The right words are hard to find, but you can let that person know that they have your support and your concern for their safety and give them the St. Jude House Crisis Line number.
Well, Val, thank you very much for your information today, and we appreciate knowing that the St. Jude House is there here in Northwest Indiana to help those people who feel that they need to get out of the domestic problems that they're in, whether that's it's physical or whether it's financial. And this is the way to start, is to get hold of people. By the way, the website once again is www.stjudehouse.org. You can find out the information there about the programs in particular during Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Val, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris.
There are questions that oftentimes come up when you get involved in visiting a doctor or being helped by a nurse or some other medical staff member as to if they really understand the human side of healthcare. And in particular, there's an opportunity that if attending classes at Indiana University Northwest in Gary, you can try for a medical humanities minor. And to talk more about it, we have a couple people that are most involved in that. Dr. Crystal Shannon, she's an assistant professor at the School of Nursing at IU Northwest, and we have one of the participants with a new online course involved in the medical humanities minor, Professor Jonathan Briggs. Actually, he's a history professor, but he follows in some very interesting areas. And thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having us, Chris.
Well, Professor Shannon, if you will start us out and explain in general terms what the idea behind the medical humanities minor is all about.
Essentially, especially when it comes in the play of healthcare, we want to ensure that healthcare providers remember that a patient's experience comes with them to the clinical setting. Once they enter the healthcare environment, be it a physician's office, an outpatient clinic, the inpatient setting, or a hospital environment, they bring all of those experiences and expectations with them. And it helps to guide them throughout their experience with us, but it also may help to impact how they experience healthcare with the providers. One thing that we hope that our students will gain from continuing their exploration into the medical humanities is the understanding of that patient's background and their story about their own lived experiences and how it's influenced how they seek health care.
Who thought up the idea of creating this medical humanities minor?
I developed it, Chris, kind of out of my own experiences of moving into a new field of research, which was I'm working on a project right now about the history of autism. And when I started to engage new scholars, I began to realize that a number of them were coming from other fields, philosophy, anthropology, sociology, but that there was a kind of shared experience among them, which was that much of their research engaged with the practice of medicine, and that there was a value in this engagement. And this was known as medical humanities, and it was happening in a number of institutions across the country. And so in talking with these kind of new colleagues of mine, I began to realize, well, this would have a value as well at my institution. And so I looked within the institution for resources to develop this, found some colleagues whose work could be fit into this idea, and, you know, lo and behold, here we are a few years later, and, you know, we're launching the ship here as well.
What type of topics can this particular minor cover when you put that into the big interdisciplinary program that's called a medical humanities minor?
Well, of course, you know, being a participant myself, it involves history, but we also offer courses on anthropology, on literature, in communications, and then as well as philosophy, particularly with ethics in medicine, which is something that really was also a kernel in this, in that there was already this ethical component required for you know, the sort of medical practices within the institution. So I was able to kind of germinate out of that to develop this program. And where I'm hoping to go with it as well is to do things as well like creative aspects. So in a number of conferences that I've been involved in with the medical humanities, one of the things that I've seen that I think would be very beneficial is that medical doctors also come to these and present their works, things like films or painting, poetry, where they're looking at the patient experience using, say, the fine arts. So I'm hoping to develop that as well here and finding allies within, say, the fine arts or within creative writing that we could integrate into this program as well. So how I'm envisioning it is kind of open-ended, where, you know, we could allow students in this to explore through a number of different ways.
Now, we know, Professor Briggs, that your new online course called The History of Disability is one of the five courses that's going to be in the curriculum that IU Northwest has set up for this new medical humanities minors this fall. What, besides your particular work that you were doing on the history of autism in France, what else led you to come up with the curriculum for this particular course?
Well, I mean, certainly part of it is rooted in my own experiences. My son is on the autism spectrum, so I began to get kind of involved with a number of organizations that work with not only autistic children, but more importantly, autistic adults. And so I began to think about, well, my own assumptions, I suppose you could say, about disability and about, you know, the rights of the disabled. And I realized, oh, well, there is a whole corpus of works on this. And, you know, I think that this is an important thing to kind of communicate to students, especially students who have a tendency to work with these kinds of populations. So so it led me to think about, well, not just kind of mental disability, but also physical disability, and what are the similarities and differences between them. And so I thought this would be worthwhile in teaching a whole course. I ran a pilot of it about 2 years ago and got some really great feedback from the students in this pilot, and it helped me to build the course as it is now. In which we start with around the 18th century and the Enlightenment, and begin to think about how Western society has framed disability in various ways, and how even the notion of disability has changed since then, where something that might be disabling at one point, one of the case studies they use about glaucoma in the 18th century. Now this is a kind of treatable condition, and so no longer is glaucoma necessarily considered to be blindness where it was before.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I know that you mentioned in some of the information and kind of setting things up for this particular course that you have available is talking about why we seem to find more staircases in newly constructed buildings, maybe instead of ramps. And it looks like that sometimes the only times you ever see ramps are ones that have to be put in because they have to meet the Americans with Disabilities Act requirements.
Absolutely. And, of course, that is a bill that is, you know, always kind of under threat. You know, usually there are groups who see it as, you know, an onerous challenge to make sure to accommodate as many populations as they can, and yet, you know, it is the law of the land at this point. So it's one of those things where we don't always conceive of how all populations would interact with a space. And in fact, the building that I'm talking to you from is our new Arts and Sciences building, which itself, you know, it has, say, one elevator to accommodate, you know, the entirety of the building. And, you know, I understand there are costs and things like this, but it does kind of speak to the assumptions that still lay in the way that we think about how we construct our own environments. And the assumption is that everybody walks, which is not really a fair assumption, and I think that getting people to engage with those assumptions is an important part of, you know, it's at the root of this class.
One of the things I note in traveling around the communities, I noted in particular there's one hospital here in Northwest Indiana that has managed, because of course the ADA requirements make it easy for people in wheelchairs to get around, they have managed to make it from one of their entrances off a parking lot to be able to do a series of ramps with a small turnaround. So you go from the level that's the ground level down to a little lower level, which is where you get access to the elevators. And this way you still come off that ramp system, I guess you could call it, and you're right there by the elevator. So it's very convenient. They've planned it out very well, and I'm sure it's been in there for quite some time. It's very interesting. You mentioned in some of the information that you've experienced in your life about having to take advantage of academic workshops, and there was one in particular that you wanted to attend, but you couldn't because of some extenuating circumstances, I understand, involving your son. Tell us about what this particular workshop is all about and what kind of problems that you've run into that maybe might get covered in this idea of medical humanities.
So the workshop was run through the National Endowment of Humanities, and I was one of the national participants in what was known as the Global History of Disability. Mm-hmm. And it was to bring together scholars from all across the country, and we were working workshops to develop a new curriculum in history of disability, to kind of share ideas and to move forward together in working in our own research on disability. So I was very excited to get the invitation, very honored. But as the workshop loomed closer, I began to realize there were some issues with clearing insurance for my son, because he receives a lot of applied behavioral analysis therapy as part of his treatment for autism, really to kind of help him to move through the world itself. So not being able to guarantee the proper amount of ABA through the insurance company because I would be moving temporarily providers to a new location, I realized that if I couldn't get that guarantee, it would not be in the best interest of my son.
Yeah.
And so without being able to accommodate my son, I had to turn it down. And, you know, they were very gracious about it. And luckily they were able to find a replacement so that the workshop could continue. And they shared as much information with me as they could about what was happening. There are some rules about people being able to participate remotely that meant that I couldn't directly participate. But I'm still affiliated with it. And so that's very nice in somewhat of a disappointment, of course, but it also, I got the materials which allowed me to integrate a number of them into this disability course that I'll be teaching this fall, so that was great. But it kind of talks again about kind of the challenges about something we may not even think about, which is, you know, there's no national healthcare law about what insurance companies are supposed to cover. This is something that is rolled back to the states. Interestingly enough, Indiana is a very progressive state when it comes to the treatment of autism, but not all states fall under that same category. And so my son, who actually lives in Florida, he gets different treatment depending on where we go. And when he comes up with me, sometimes it's much easier to get this treatment, where in other cases it's a much more uphill battle. And so even in these like things that we might assume there are little challenges in, like, say, you know, the insurance industry, it's actually, there are all these challenges that face people at all levels. And so I think that, again, it's an interesting conversation to have, like, what are the assumptions about, say, like, health that we talk about when, you know, because disability and health are these kind of two poles that we constantly might move between. You know, what are the assumptions about where those boundaries lay? And I think that's one of the things that my own experiences kind of feed into.
Now, Professor Crystal Shannon, be involved in this from the School of Nursing perspective. Are you looking forward with great anticipation to what some of the courses and the other work that's going to happen as this new curricula gets going?
Absolutely. You know, conventionally, nursing has always been looked at as the caring profession, and it's something that we take great pride in because our main focus is to look at the patient from a holistic nature and from a holistic perspective. However, it can be very difficult and cumbersome when you really do get bogged down with a lot of the tasks that are involved in the clinical care process. But we don't want to lose sight of the patient as a person, and that's where that humanistic component comes into play. And I really do believe that our students, by participating in these types of courses, will, as they gain their clinical skills, they won't forget the true nature of nursing, which is that caring perspective.
Now, again, ready for this particular curriculum to begin here this fall semester, have you had a chance to talk with some students that you've experienced in some of your other courses before then as to whether they're looking forward to maybe signing up for some of these courses?
I actually have. I've talked to them very frequently about them as they're looking for electives and they're thinking about minors, for them to strongly consider this as an adjunctive minor to a profession that really promotes the encouragement and the connection to patient care. And I do believe that by participation in it, it will just give them a wealth of experience, a wealth of foundational background that they will be able to take with them into the clinical care environment.
Now, if anyone is interested, any students or family members have students at IU Northwest interested in finding out more about the Medical Humanities Program, how can they find out more now?
Well, there is of course, a website within the institution that gives them all the information they would need. They can certainly contact me as, I guess, the kind of shadow director of all of this at this point. So by email is the best way these days. And so my email is jwbriggs@iun.edu, and that's a great way of, if nothing else, just kind of open the contact, and I can kind of tell them more about what they can expect in these kinds of, in this program and in these kinds of courses.
That's Professor Jonathan Briggs. He is primarily a professor of history, but he's very much involved in one of the new online courses here, involved in this medical humanities program that is underway at IU Northwest, along with Dr. Crystal Shannon. She's an assistant professor of the School of Nursing. And thank you very much, both of you, for being with us to talk about this. And we hope that a lot more students and potential students are very interested in this. We'll get signed up and look into these courses that IU Northwest is going to offer.
Thanks so much,
Chris.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
We're starting off October, noting there's special deadlines that if you have individual retirement accounts, IRAs, that you should be aware of. And to find out more, let's check in with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Greg, thanks for joining us once again on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is very important. There, I guess, are several critical deadlines I guess you could call them that we should know about. Tell us, first off, why they're critical, and we can go through them.
So a lot of people aren't familiar that the extension is October 15th, or I should say they are familiar with that when it comes to tax filings. But it's also a deadline when it comes to recharacterization or withdrawals from contributions made. Recharacterizations of Roth IRAs that were done in 2017, if you did convert one, you still have the opportunity to recharacterize. And it may be for various reasons. If the account didn't perform well and you converted at a higher rate than what it is today, or you decide that you didn't want that tax liability to come in for 2017, you still have that recourse.
Now, we're talking here, I guess, about converting traditional IRAs into Roth IRAs. And for any of our listeners that, for some reason, aren't familiar with Roth IRAs, the difference between the two, please give us an idea.
Yeah, so real quick, the traditional IRAs, the contributions are done as a pre-tax. So when you distribute the money, the monies are considered income or taxable upon distribution. Where Roth IRAs, you forego the deduction today, but based on some time horizons as you wait, which is 5 years and 59 and a half, you essentially then can take all distributions tax-free. And there's several benefits to get into that. Obviously mitigating potential tax liabilities. They don't count as provisional income against Social Security. So there are some very large advantages of having Roth distributions in retirement.
I guess it would be wise then, I guess, to have a Roth IRA, especially if you have like an annuity where you'll have a distribution of in payments over a period of time. But those distributions are taxable, aren't they?
Yeah, so depending on whether your IRAs or annuities, which are deferred growth, where the distributions then become 100% taxable as either income and or interest, the Roth characterization allows you to take those distributions. And I think the significance this year, Chris, of this deadline is opportunity has been removed with the new tax laws, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So there may be some confusion out there, people thinking, hey, we no longer can do it. And the answer is correct. You can no longer do it for conversions that you did this year. But the ones that you did last year still have the provision to recharacterize prior to October 15th.
So I guess it does give you an opportunity that if you've set up a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA and you've contributed to it and you have some second thoughts about it, you can make that change over now then.
Yeah, absolutely. And it could, like I said, it could be for several reasons. Generally, people will do it if there's a large decline in the value. It's like if I converted $10,000 and paid taxes on it, but it's worth $8,000, maybe I want to recharacterize it because it's only $8,000 now and I paid taxes on $2,000 additional dollars that I didn't need to. Because when you do recharacterize, just so everybody understands, you do pay the taxes from funds outside of that particular account. So it might be other reasons that are involved in it. Maybe the tax liability was more than people anticipated. They wanted to eliminate that tax liability. But primarily, those are some of the general reasons why you want to reconsider the conversion.
Mm-hmm. Now, I also understand, too, that you may or may not have an IRA program set up through your employer. And that's a different deal as well, too. Or you have the opportunity, maybe, to create something even different, can't you?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing with the deadline is if you made contributions, one of the tough things about doing traditional IRA contributions outside of a company plan is they fall to income limitations and there's specific criteria to qualify for, in the case of both the traditional and Roth, the actual contribution, and in the case of the traditional, to actually count for deductible contribution for your tax implications. So the opportunity that you have with this deadline is if you're not getting or did not get the full deduction that you anticipated getting, or you find out that you made contributions that you shouldn't have, you can remove them as a no harm, no foul. Otherwise, those excess contributions could create problems for you within the contract.
Do these make for some big confusing issues, especially if an employer is able to set up an IRA account for you and other employees?
Yeah, I mean, there's different limitations. The confusion is whether or not, you're married or single, whether one spouse has what they call a qualified plan, or whether two spouses, or whether neither of them have. Mm-hmm. And then based on those particular criteria, it's based on family or household income, whether you be single or joint. So there's about three different parameters that come into play. And for some folks, they don't necessarily know where their compensation is going to end, especially if they have some type of commission-driven income or outside income source, or they had a significant raise or change in income that they weren't anticipating. Then by the time they get to year end, what was good the previous year, they find out no longer fit that criteria, and they do have the opportunity to recharacterize those contributions.
So we realize we've come into a situation that because the Trump administration and Congress have gone ahead and set all this up, and it's been passed and it's been enacted, that the changes in federal law have really made things more confusing, much more confusing than just different tax rates.
Well, and not only the confusion, I think, Chris, I think the biggest thing is the recourse is going to be a lot, it's just not going to be available.
Yeah.
You know, where if you made a mistake, most of the time, I would say probably close to 100% of the time, it's usually not intentionally, right? But now if you do something and you feel like it wasn't in your best interest, you're kind of committed to it now. So you just have to be a little bit more careful moving forward under these new laws. When considering a Roth conversion, making sure it's something that you will want to be committed to for the rest of your life, basically, because you will not have this opportunity to go back and say, hey, let me do this over. I rethought this, or my situation has changed.
Well, it sounds like that's the opportunity that you have now before the deadline on October 15th to get with your financial advisor or with some financial advisor. If you don't have one, get one chosen and then be able to get this all set up so that you're in the clear and you're not going to pay these penalties that you're liable to pay here after the after this tax year to be sure, certainly.
Yeah, exactly. And you bring up the point or the reason why, because there is an excess penalty. It's actually a 6% excess contribution penalty. So if you made a contribution to an IRA that did not qualify, whether it be a traditional or a Roth, and you don't remove it, every year you accrue a 6% penalty of that contribution. So it's not, I mean, it's a pretty serious slap on the hand. So it's not something you want to take lightly. If it's in there, you need to get it out. If you get it out by the deadline, there's no penalty. If you get it out or sometime in the future, they'll go back and accrue that interest for all the years that it was in there that it shouldn't have been.
Boy, you'd hate to think that you might lose everything in your IRA account just because of penalties.
Yeah, and like I said, 6% is a pretty sizable excess penalty charge. So you just want to make sure for some reason, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know what, didn't qualify, it's in there, I'm just going to leave it for investment. But they don't realize that there are consequences to those excess contributions.
Well, Greg, thanks for bringing all this up here, and hope that people will realize they've got this deadline of October 15th to reach when it deals with either a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA in these cases here. And we appreciate you spending some time talking with us about it.
Yeah, and just one other thing I'll add real quick, Chris, you still have the opportunity to establish, you know, a SEP IRA if you're self-employed by this 15th of October as well and still make a contribution, or an employer in that regards can still make a contribution to his simple IRA or SEP plans by this 15th if they had, in fact, filed an extension.
Well, time to go talk to the advisor about that, and thank you for spending some time with us today, Greg.
No problem, Chris. I always enjoy it.
That's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. Valparaiso University will be offering students a pathway to a new degree beginning in the fall semester of 2019. It's environmental engineering. The School of Engineering Dean Eric Johnson was with us on Regionally Speaking to explain why it's being created.
We looked at what I think is a big societal need over the next 10 to 20 years. With our increase in population, they're expecting 10 billion people on the earth by 2050. There's going to be increasing challenge to provide clean air and clean water, we believe, to people worldwide. And so the idea behind this degree was to really look at creating graduates that would be able to help with the quality of life as this population continues to rise.
I know that with the heavy industry that we do have here in Northwest Indiana, a lot of it is in need of having environmental engineers to help keep track of the processes and can keep all the processes legal, to be sure. So this certainly would be a great opportunity for students to get their degree work and stay in Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely, and that was the other big motivating factor for us is with all the heavy industry in Northwest Indiana, it seemed like a natural fit. More and more students are interested in the environment and making sure that industries meet the regulations that are put out there. And so industries are looking for these types of graduates. Regulatory agencies are looking for these types of graduates. There's a number of consulting firms also in Northwest Indiana that are looking for graduates. So my hope is that a lot of our graduates will see the opportunities here in Northwest Indiana and actually stay once they graduate.
Dean, tell us a little bit about the coursework that's going to be offered leading to this environmental engineering degree, and how does it dovetail with the courses that are already there in the College of Engineering that students may need to take or they may want to take to go along with it?
Sure. Most schools offer some type of environmental engineering track, and it's usually under their civil engineering degree program.
Mm-hmm.
And probably 10 to 15 years ago, environmental engineering was all about wastewater treatment. But since then, with all the other environmental issues around air, water, and soil that have come up, it's really broadened. And so that was one other reason why we thought this is a perfect time to launch this program. And so our students will come in, and they'll take probably about 25 to 30% similar courses with civil engineers. And then the last 2.5 years, they'll branch off and focus a lot more on either one of those three areas, courses around air, water, or soil, or a combination of all if they want to keep more broad. But then also we'll talk a little bit about the regulatory aspect of environmental engineering to go with that.
Have you found in doing the research leading up to offering the prospectus, I suppose, to the administration to offer this particular degree, that we found that it's not only in demand because that the job opportunities will be out there, but also, too, that there's a lot of citizen and public activism, I guess, and advocacy to have some type of degree work that's offered out of Valparaiso University to be able to bring the students out, to get them interested and get them off to a good career?
Yeah, more and more students coming in, we're seeing this group of students wanting to come in and really make a difference in society. And so around the environment, around other civic engagement, especially in engineering, we're seeing more and more of that. And so it was actually a very easy sell to the administration here to offer this degree. It fits our mission very well, and students see this as a part of their vocation as they continue with their career later in life.
And you also have some very nice new facilities that are built there on the VU campus that can probably take advantage of the opportunities to help set up classrooms and teach students there too.
Absolutely. The Center for the Sciences for Chemistry and Biochemistry just opened. It's a $40 million building right next to engineering, and so there will be a number of laboratories in there that we can take advantage of. We're also renovating a couple laboratories in our building, our engineering building, to use with this program.
Now, of course, we're focusing here in particular on the School of Engineering, but can't forget the liberal arts. How do they fit into the picture to be able to offer students to come to Valparaiso University and are interested in the environmental engineering coursework to be able to stay on track with the liberal arts?
Well, to me, that's a big selling point for Valparaiso, because we are really an engineering college within a liberal arts university. And when I talk to employers, what they tell me is one of the reasons they love our students is because they are very good speakers and technical writers. And so without that strong liberal arts component, our students couldn't develop that here at Valparaiso.
Now, Dean, if you will tell us if anyone is interested in finding out more about this new environmental engineering degree program, which, by the way, is going to be in effect, I guess, the fall semester of next year. How can somebody find out more about this particular coursework? Maybe sign up if they haven't already done so, or if they happen to be a current VU student and they would like to change majors and switch around and take advantage of this.
Our website is being renovated right now and should be up for this program within the next week. Mm-hmm. So that's www.valpo.edu/engineering to get more information. What I'd really hope that any prospective student would contact our admissions office to set up a campus visit. And at that time, they can come into the College of Engineering and get a visit from one of our faculty members in this area, and they can tell them all about the program.
That's Valparaiso University School of Engineering Dean Eric Johnson. The state commission that's responsible for examining Indiana's alcohol law says the local communities ought to get involved to decide whether they should add more alcohol permits to the area. It's part of the final recommendations of the 2-year study commission. State law restricts how many alcohol permits are allowed in every community, and currently, if a city or a town wants more, the General Assembly has to pass legislation specific to that area. The Alcohol Code Revision Commission unanimously recommends what Republican Representative Representative Ben Schmaltz is seeing as a better approach, a ballot referendum in any community that wants to increase its quota.
It's an absolute affirmation. If you want it, there's consequences, but you said you wanted it.
Republican Representative Matt Lehman says that those referenda should go both ways.
If you're giving someone the opportunity to expand, I think you're going to be hard-pressed to say, but you can't put a local question out to reduce.
The commission also recommends a state limit on how long someone can hold a new alcohol permit without using it. The current tap is about 7 years. The commission's unanimous recommendation would be to lower that cap to 3 years. Time now for once again another edition of Eye on the Arts, and now here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. Welcome back, Kirk.
Hello, John.
And you're here to tell us about the October concerts.
Russian.
There are two.
Yes, Russian. So, John, this is the first time we won't be able to offer the children the chance to come to the Star, and our theme this year is Follow the Music.
Right.
So we have education concerts on Tuesday the 23rd at Monbeck Auditorium in Highland, and the next morning on the 24th, we have them at Valparaiso High School, and the music is all about Tchaikovsky and Sleeping Beauty.
Yes.
Well, yes.
That is all Russian then.
It certainly is.
It's little baby Russian and then adult Russian.
Adult Russian. The concerts are at 9:30 and 10:45 in the morning, and we hope the teachers and children will join us. You'll learn all about the orchestra, but we'll show you some pictures of the fairies and Princess Aurora and the prince and the dragon and all that stuff and Sleeping Beauty waltz. So I think it's a really wonderful concert for the kids.
And the orchestra performed the Sleeping Beauty suite.
Yes.
Last spring.
Last spring, yes.
People loved it.
Oh, it's gorgeous stuff.
The grown-ups loved it.
Oh, yeah. And that's why we're doing more. So on Friday night, again with Follow the Music, we're playing our first concert at Living Hope.
Yes.
That's on the 26th of October. And I think it's a gorgeous hall. It's been completely refurbished over the summer. It's incredibly intimate. That's a great thing about a hall like this. You can see the music.
What, 900 and something?
More, I think, John, right? In our last meeting, didn't we say with the refurbishing of the seats, the seats are? I think it's 1,100 or 1,000. I think.
Yeah,
I think so.
More tickets.
And so it's Scheherazade, which people have asked me for and asked me for and asked me for. It's such a big, exotic, gorgeous Russian showpiece. But then Richard Herschel, who from the Chicago Symphony Orchestra cello section is coming to play three Russian cello pieces with us on the first half.
Well, tell us about those as well.
Yeah. So we're playing the Rachmaninoff Vocalise.
Which was one of my favorite
tunes. It's incredible. And it has been transcribed for cello instead of for voice and orchestra, but for cello and orchestra. And then we're playing the Lenski aria from Eugene Onegin. So
gorgeous too.
Oh my gosh, it's killer. Kuda, it's killer. Poor Lenski and Onegin, who are going to shoot each other in just a moment by the lake over, and they don't want to do any of it. And it's so sad. And it's for the cello now. And then he's going to play the famous Tchaikovsky Rococo variations.
Okay, well, I know the first two pieces are very, very haunting.
Oh, it's great word. Great word. Just like, you know, when I was talking to you on the radio here, I was like putting arrows through my heart as we talked because they are just killer Russian sadness. You
what
know?
Is it about the Russian composers of the, particularly of the 19th century, I guess?
Yeah, and Tchaikovsky, of course, who we really believe committed suicide.
Uh-huh.
He happened to be gay, and in those days, he and his brother both, who wrote many of his librettos, and in those days, a gay man was just sent to the gulag to just starve to death and die. You know, and that's part of his tragedy because when he tried to be married, he was so terribly, terribly, married in the traditional Russian 1890 sense of it to a woman. He was so depressed. And then life then, when you think about it, I think is right before the Russian Revolution, the first Russian Revolution of 1905. So, you know, anybody who wasn't the Tsar had really a horrible life in that country.
Well, the Tsar and his court.
Yes.
His peers. Not that he had peers, but other rich people.
Just terrible, you know.
Yeah.
Just terrible.
I know, you know, but they created those dictator monarch type families, the Romanovs in this case, mm-hmm. created such incredible art.
They did.
By funding it, I mean. By
no.
Being patrons of
it. I mean, whether you like one of those eggs.
I know. You know? They're stunning.
Or I don't know if they ever found that huge gold art, you know, that the gold thing from the museum that the Russians had before the Nazis came. And they said it was stunning. I can't remember what the name of it. But you're right. And all the literature. The amazing literature.
Right.
Astonishing. Poor, and then, of course, Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, Prokofiev, Khachaturian, Shostakovich, all of those guys, you know. I say to people, you know, I'm Canadian and we don't produce any great music. Don't tell anybody that because we're all so happy and everything's fine and we have nice chocolate bars and, you know, and
healthcare.
So, yeah, same with Switzerland. We know, what do they do? It's a nice country. Everybody's fine, you know, but let's have a little tragedy.
Let's have a little repression.
And then you have Beethoven.
Okay. All right, Kirk. Thank you. Well, it sounds like a great concert. And thank you for being here to tell us about both the children's education concerts and the Russian cello.
Thanks. Oh, you're welcome.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear this conversation and previous Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.